WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Inside of us, we both know you belong with Victor. You're part of his work, the thing that keeps him going. If that plane leaves the ground and you're not with him, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life.
What about us?
We'll always have Paris. We didn't have, we lost it until you came to Casablanca. We got it back last night.
When I said I would never leave you.
And you never will. But I've got a job to do too. Where I'm going, you can't follow. What I've got to do, you can't be any part of. Ilse, I'm no good at being noble, but it doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. Someday you'll understand that. No. He's looking at you, kid.
Humphrey Bogart is one of the greatest movie stars Hollywood ever produced, but he didn't get a foothold in Hollywood until he was nearly middle-aged. My guest, Eric Lax, is the co-author of a new Bogart biography. He took over the book after the 1994 death of A.M. Sperber, who had spent 7 years researching Bogart. Eric Lax is also the author of a Woody Allen biography. Bogart first established himself as a powerful screen presence in the 1936 film The Petrified Forest. He played an escaped gangster named Duke Mantee, hiding out at a roadside diner with hostages played by the young Betty Davis and Leslie Howard.
The cops ain't likely to catch up with us, not tonight. So we can all be quiet and peaceable and have a few beers together and listen to the music and not make any wrong moves. Because I may as well tell you folks that old Ruby there with the gun, he's pretty nervous and jumpy. And he's got the itch between his fingers. So let's everybody stay where they are.
Let there be killing. All this evening I've had a feeling of destiny closing in. Do you believe in astrology?
I couldn't say, pal.
The Warner Brothers studio was reluctant to cast Bogart in The Petrified Forest, but he had co-starred in the Broadway production with Leslie Howard, who was also starring in the film. And Howard cabled Jack Warner saying, "No Bogart, no deal."
Howard realized how well he acted with Bogart on Broadway. The play is really about the dichotomy of these two men and how different they are and yet how intertwined they are. Duke Mantee is the... is a killer, but he is also a rugged individualist. He lives by a very strong code that that the Leslie Howard character, a wandering dilettante writer who's lost all of his faith in humanity, sees as something real and passionate in the man, however misguided it might have been or however dangerous it might have been. And the two of them played off that very, very well with each other. Leslie Howard had a great deal of power at the time. He was a very popular film star as well as a Broadway star, and he had a great deal of clout in his contract. But what really, I think, allowed Bogart to come out, as much as Leslie Howard had pushed for it, was that Edward G. Robinson was making $80,000 a picture for the Warner Brothers and was not working. And Jack Warner couldn't stand to be paying an actor not to work. And at one point had thought to put him in the role as Duke Mantee. The problem was is that Betty Davis, who was the female lead in there, Warner Brothers also wanted to have what they called the greatest love story of. Sent for Betty Davis and Leslie Howard. They wanted to reunite them. And so it was very hard to have a great story with Betty Davis and Leslie Howard if you had Edward G. Robinson up there in the billing.
Oh, you mean because he'd be upstaging them?
He'd be upstaging them. It would be hard to have a love story between Leslie Howard and Betty Davis if the credits said Edward G. Robinson starring in The Petrified Forest with Leslie Howard and Betty Davis, or however the credits would have gone, or even all three of them in the top billing. But with Bogart, you know, safely put down in fifth billing where he was, you could make this the great Leslie Howard, Betty Davis vehicle and not have that problem.
So Bogart ends up at the Warner Brothers studio. Did the studio recognize his talent after Petrified Forest? I mean, at this point, he's in his mid-30s. He has, a receding hairline, which isn't what you're supposed to have if you're a Hollywood star.
Right. He's 36 years old. He had made an unsuccessful... trip out to Hollywood several years earlier, done a half dozen films, many of them for Warner Brothers that were kind of unmemorable, and had come back here. He was paid, his contract with Warner Brothers was for 3 weeks of work at $750 to play Duke Mantee. That was it. That's what he came out west for. It's his last chance as a movie actor. Well, they realized very early on in the filming there was something special here, and while they immediately moved to put him under contract, they did so for the first option of $550 a week, $200 less than he'd made for 3 weeks of temporary work, with gradual increases going up every 6 months. But the problem was, as much as he was a wonderful actor, and they recognized this, he was sort of the fifth man on the murderer's row pecking order at Warner Brothers. You still had Cagney, you still had Robinson, you had Paul Muni and George Raft. These were huge box office stars who brought in millions and millions of dollars for their films. So Bogart may have been a wonderful new find, but he was not the box office value of these guys. So he was he really had to wait his turn until, as the joke went, you know, you could bump somebody, you know, you bump one of them off and then you can move one rung up the ladder. And so Bogart really labored in a string of terrible films after Petrified Forest, where I think one count that was done in the first 45 films that he did for Warner Brothers, in eight of them he was hanged or electrocuted, in nine of them he was sent to prison for life, and in another dozen, you know, he was riddled with bullets. So that's 29 or 30. 30 times he turns into the corpse in the eighth reel, you know, while the other guy gets to go on until the 10th reel. So he really had to sit and wait his turn. And what changed his life really was he made an appearance in Dark Victory with Bette Davis, where he plays a stable hand, a trainer, a horse trainer, Michael O'Leary. And Bogart not only spoke in a convincing brogue, but he also, as one critic said, showed that he could act without a gun. And that was 1939.
So after he made Dark Victory, Paul Muni, one of the people ahead of him in the pecking order, left Warner Brothers. And then the director of advertising and publicity at Warner Brothers saw Bogart in Dark Victory and sent a letter to the person you describe as the master of publicity stunts at Warner Brothers.
Yes, Martin Weiser.
And said, "I want you to give the utmost attention to the building of Humphrey Bogart to stardom in as quick a time as possible."
Suddenly, Bogart was the man that had the gangster with sex appeal. There was a press release that went out and a story falling was, do tough guys have sex appeal? And the answer was, you know, if they're Humphrey Bogart, of course they do. And stories like this were planted everywhere. Martin Weiser was really just a genius at being able to build people up through the press.
And that helped Bogart's career?
Yes, I think what really helped is Bogart's career were two things. One, Paul Muni fell into a disagreement with Warner Brothers over High Sierra, actually, which allowed Bogart to go into it, and his contract ended. What, you know, Jack Warner did not like actors; he didn't like writers very much either. And there's a memo or a telegram that we have in the book where he's complaining to his New York office saying, you know, it's important that we're constantly getting new stars up here because the old ones, as they get more and more powerful, become harder and harder to control and finally come to a point where they bring in less and less money. And so you may be the hugest star, as Paul Muni was, that suddenly the you became almost too big for the studio and they said, you know, what's your effectiveness is up, and suddenly you'd be without a contract, or you'd get angry and rip up your contract, as Paul Muni did. And each time that happened, somebody could move up the ladder. So that happened with Bogart, and it also happened is that George Raft made as many bad career choices as anybody could possibly do. Whenever he was up for a film, he said he never wanted to play out-and-out heavies or out-and-out bad guys. And what had become really was called, it was called the Bogart role. Director Vincent Sherman had a line saying, if it's a louse heel, the word was, give it to Bogart.
Let me get back to the pecking order. One of the people ahead of Bogart in the pecking order was George Raft, who was on tap to play the lead in Maltese Falcon.
Right.
How come he didn't get that part and Humphrey Bogart did?
Well, in part, Bogart convinced him that it was... not necessarily to his great credit, but the real thing that did it more than anything else is that Warner Brothers had put John Huston in as the director. And Raft didn't want to appear with a first-time director. And so he turned it down. And Huston, who didn't like Raft at all, was just completely thrilled because Raft had a terrible reputation. He'd come on and he would hold things up and he would be difficult to work with. And when Raft finally did turn down the role, Houston said, you know, I rejoiced. I think the subtext for all of this, because nothing is ever as it seems in Hollywood, especially in the way that when the studios ran things, is that Warner's didn't really want Raff to do it. They were trying to ship him off to 20th Century Fox and something, and I think they were rather hoping to be able to put Bogart in this. And they used Houston as the first-time director, I think, to scare off George Raft. I think that his great service to the film before it was made was that his great service to the film afterward is evident on the screen. But nobody knew how brilliantly he had filmed it.
You write about how the ending of The Maltese Falcon was changed and how that changed the larger meaning of the movie. What was the original ending and how has it changed?
The original ending was a much sort of, the way that it was written by Hammett, which was a much sort of seedier, immoral kind of ending where the Bogart's character, Sam Spade, ends up with the wife of his partner, who has been murdered. But it was so sort of smarmy and self-defeatist in that, is that what came out of this instead was really what we identify, I think, as the Bogart hero, and certainly as the modern-day private eye. Here's a man who has a code that he lives up to. It means that you find your partner's killer, even if it means turning over your love to the law, and that you have to stand for something in life. And that's what, you know, it may be that Bogart's characters were never really entirely on the right side of the law. Certainly, you know, Roy Earle in High Sierra was an embattled man who was kind of equally at odds with himself and with the public morality. But you found yourself drawn to these people because they stood for something. Even if they didn't stand for what you believed in, you could kind of understand how they came to that.
How has Bogart's personal life changed by his switch from the heavy to the romantic hero?
It was, his personal life was a difficult one. He was, he was married four times. The first marriage was to Helen Menken, a Broadway actress who was much more famous than he. It lasted only a few months, and within a year and a half they had divorced, but they remained friends, and he continued to see her, I think, romantically for some years after that. He was then married to Mary Phillips, another actress, at the time that he was finding his career in Los Angeles and she in New York, and that also fell apart after several years. He was then married in a very destructive relationship to a woman named Mayo Metho, a marriage that went on for about 6 years, that was really during the time that he was going from the heavy to the romantic lead. Mayo had terrible drinking problems. She was diagnosed as being paranoid and schizophrenic. She had been a huge champion of his career in the beginning, and suddenly as her illnesses developed and his fame grew, she became more and more resentful and jealous. She had set fire to the house once. She stabbed him. They were known as the Battling Bogarts. They would have these public and private brawls really that went on that seemed cute at the time, but of course, you know, were anything but. It was really a kind of a hideous display. And this marriage was just really eating them both alive and disintegrating farther and farther. And finally, he, in 1944, making To Have and Have Not, meets a newcomer to Hollywood, Lauren Bacall, 19 years old, 25 years his junior. And suddenly, the line that he used at the end of Casablanca, you know, describing Casablanca about it, you know, it didn't ring true to him. I think if you look at what happened in his life, you can understand why. He had been in this terribly destructive marriage. He found himself falling in love with this young woman. At the same time, felt a terrible loyalty to Mayo. He was born in 1899 and described himself as a last century man. It had that good Victorian sense of principles and loyalty and duty that you needed to do. And he felt very strongly about that and knew that while Bacall represented a happy future for him and maybe the first really great love of his life, for Mayo, it was really going to just send her farther and farther into the abyss that she was falling into. And he was tortured by this and really tried to leave, and Mayo promised to reform, and he went back and they tried it again. And at the same time, he wanted nothing more than to be with Bacall, but realized that, you know, that he had this duty to perform. Finally, he said enough is enough and was able to make the break. But I think that he found a happiness that he never expected, and they had a dozen years together that were really terrific.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Lax. He's the co-author of Bogart, a new biography of Humphrey Bogart. This is Fresh Air. Back with Eric Lax, co-author of a new biography of Humphrey Bogart called Bogart. Let's talk a little bit about Humphrey Bogart's politics. He became active in the Committee for the First Amendment, which is a committee that supported the Hollywood 10, the blacklisted screenwriters in Hollywood. And he became active in this committee, I think, at about the same time that he became one of the highest paid actors in Hollywood. What were his politics at the time? Did he think of himself as a politically motivated person? Had he ever taken a political stand before?
Yes, you know, which is very much against the character that he played. Usually he has a, you know, he starts off as this apolitical loner who then, you know, acts very in a very politically minded way at the end. But Bogart really, really was, although he never really declared himself actively political until 1940, when he had been, after he'd been hauled before the House Un-American Activities Committee that was headed then by a man named Martin Dies from Texas. Bogart had been falsely accused of being a communist and was just furious in his denial on this. And meanwhile, his name is being dragged across the papers. And as a result of that, he joined up Franklin Roosevelt's election campaign and was very active in that, and again in 1944. So that in 1947, when the House Un-American Activities Committee began investigating communist influences in Hollywood, this following a sweep of conservative victories in the 1946 elections, Bogart was very sympathetic to his friends John Huston and Philip Dunn, who began what became the Committee for the First Amendment, because Hollywood writers were being subpoenaed to come and testify in Washington, and there were 45 were subpoenaed. 19 immediately said they wouldn't cooperate, became known as the unfriendly 19, and out of that came the Hollywood 10, are the ones who actually were called and refused to testify.
Well, Jack Warner, the head of Warner Brothers, was not very happy to see his top star getting involved in the fight against the House Un-American Activities Committee. What kind of pressure did Warner Brothers put on Bogart at that time?
Tremendous. You know, Warner had been a great liberal and suddenly had turned conservative. After the Committee for the First Amendment went to Washington, that even though Bogart was not the leader of the group, he was such a major star that he and Bacall became the focal point for it, and they really became the lightning rod of it. And so it became their committee, even though it wasn't. And they had gone there just saying that, you know, these guys can believe whatever it is they want. We're not supporting communism, but it's not illegal to have your own deeply held political beliefs. This at a time when Dwight Eisenhower, was refusing to say whether he was a Republican or a Democrat. And so, but Warner, the group attracted just tremendous publicity, much of it negative. And tremendous pressure was put on Bogart to recant, basically, his position. And he refused to do it for some weeks. And finally, Warner's assistant Steve Trilling and Bob Considine, a conservative journalist, took Bogart down to the Hearst building and said, here are all the clips we have. Here are all the things that can be amassed against you. And if you expect ever to work again or for you to support your wife in the way that you think you should, you need to stand back from this. And Bogart hated that. I think that he was a man of deeply felt principle. And I think that he gave up his own principles in this case to protect his wife.
What do you think was in the file that they were threatening with or blackmailing him with?
It was, I think, just a rehash of everything they'd done, but it was just saying, here's your whole life, you know, with every unproved deed that's been done. But just like he'd been hauled before the committee in 1940, it was the same kind of stuff. It was largely a collection of lies, or entirely a collection of lies. But it would be used in him in such a way that that his life would be ruined. And he said, I want my young wife and my children to have something better. So what he did is he said the trip to Washington had been a mistake, which devastated his compatriots who had gone in that. Phil Dunn, whose idea really the Committee for the First Amendment was, felt that Bogart was perfectly within his rights to do that. He said, the problem was, he said, Bogart was really the only star of that magnitude. He said, if we had had two or three, it would have diffused the lightning that came down, and it would have really made it much better on him. He said, I never held it against him that he did that. Bogart immediately regretted that he had done it, and within a week of that time was rejoining the publicity releases that were coming out from anti-blacklist groups. But by that time, the damage was done. As far as everyone is concerned, he had stood back from that. And while it assured the rest of his career at Warner's, it certainly damaged him in the eyes of many of his compatriots.
Do you have a favorite acting story about Bogart, about him as a performer?
Yes, I do. When he was making Across the Pacific, directed by John Huston, starring Mary Astor, and this was the occasion that He was stabbed by his wife, Maya Metho. He had come back from the Finlandia Baths, which was a steam room and massage place for that a lot of show business people went to, not far from where he lived. And he came home that night, and Maya was convinced that it had become a brothel, and she was incredibly jealous. She had had a lot to drink, and she had she would hum "Embraceable You" when she was about to cause danger. And she was humming "Embraceable You" and stabbed him with a big kitchen knife. And fortunately did not do severe damage. They were able to get a doctor to come in and not report it to the police and keep it quiet and put in several stitches. But he was in obvious pain. He gets up the next morning, he goes to work, and for the first time in John Huston's memory, he's late to the set. And Huston, concerned by this, goes into the dressing room to see what's gone on, and Bogart is changing into his costume, and there is this stab wound on his back. And he got up, shot the scenes, completed the entire day, and went home. So I think that the fact that he, in the face of anything, he got out there and could do it. He would learn his lines on the set. There were a period during his life with Mayo when life was so chaotic that he could never study the lines at home. So he'd come to the set, he'd sit down, and within an hour, he'd have it all done for the day.
Hmm. Well, Eric Lax, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Eric Lax is the co-author of Bogart. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.